Hi, this is Lindsay Behrens. Welcome to the Maximu Podcast, a podcast about New York City theater, mostly theater beyond Broadway. On today's episode, I am joined by Nicole from Mildly Bitter's Musings, and we talk about lots of stuff. Some of it controversial, some of it extremely funny, or at least we think so. And we hope you'll let us know what you think about the episode on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at Maximu NY, that's M-A-X-A-M-O-O-N-Y, and on Twitter at Maximu. As always, links to all of the shows and articles and theater companies that we talked about are included on Maximu.com. Just click on podcasts. If you're listening to this episode before Friday, February 21st at 5 p.m., we are giving away two tickets to an immersive theater performance called Four Chambers. It's by Jody Oberfelder. And if you like things like Then She Fell, the immersive Alice in Wonderland production, or Sleep No More, the immersive Macbeth performance by Punch Drunk, this is very much in the spirit of those shows. And it's a multi-room performance space where in each room there is a piece of visual performance or dance art that is inspired by the functions and meaning of the heart. So to enter to win those tickets, follow Maximu on Twitter and send a tweet that says, follow Maximu and retweet to win two tickets to Four Chambers. You can find the tweet language and more information about the giveaway on Maximu.com. And even if you don't win the tickets, we hope you'll check out that show because it is really cool and it is definitely a unique experience. And now let's get to the episode. Enjoy the show. So you just came from the final performance of Twelfth Night on Broadway.
Yes. Which, if anyone has seen any plays with Mark Rylance in them, the man gives a wonderful speech at the curtain of every final show I've ever seen him do. And it's very moving, and everyone's crying, and tonight was no exception.
Oh, I kind of ache with jealousy right now. Not just because of that you got to see that, but you know that saying, is it better to have loved than lost than not loved at all? Sometimes I wonder if it's better to have just not seen the really great theater. Because it's so painful that not everything matches that excellence. And that show was so good.
Yeah, it kind of ruins you for other productions.
It does. It ruins you.
And even Mark Rylance said something about sort of like, oh, you audiences here have embraced this so much and have really caught on to all the things that you've ruined our careers for all other things that we do, hereafter. Which is definitely not true, but good enough. I mean,
it was a sweet sentiment.
Yes, lovely, lovely thought. And it's funny to have seen it in London on the West End from the audience, and then to see it in New York. And there's a slight casting change between London and New York, and that has made all the difference for me. I enjoyed it.
You should explain the casting change.
When I saw it in London, Johnny Flynn, who's a sort of singer-songwriter who was in Jerusalem in the West End, played the role of Viola Cesario. And when it came to New York, Sam Barnett, who was already in the company, who played the smaller role of Sebastian, got sort of up to the larger role. And as everybody has said, you've said, Aileen has said, everybody was like, you have to watch his performance upstage in this show. And it's true. He gives so much. It's coming out of his face all the time.
His face is so expressive in a way that is not overacting. It just seems to be pouring out of him.
Yeah. It's like when you say somebody has love in their eyes, you can see it. You can see when he is projecting love across the stage at the object of his affection in a way that you're just like, I want to be loved like that. Look at me.
Can I just angle so I'm in your gaze? Right. Even though I know you're not directing it at me, I just want to be in the gaze.
I know you have a boyfriend, Sam, but look at me like that. Yeah, it is the warmth of a thousand suns. It is just, it's incredible. And you really have to, it's funny because it is such a subtle performance in a piece of theater that can be quite broad, can be, it's you know, there's pratfalls and lots of physical humor and big moments. There's lots of big humor. And yet I do think that the reason this version was more successful for me was that that underlying desire between these characters, that which is, you know, sort of confusing to them within the scheme of the plot, because it's, I mean, it's the boss who's fallen in love with his manservant, who's sort of like, well, I'm not gay, but I don't know why I feel this way about this young boy. Turns out because he's a girl and it's okay in the scheme of Shakespeare. But that, like, that underlying passion between them is really powerful. Like, even Liam Brennan, I thought, was better this time. Like, I sort of...
Which one is he?
He plays Duke Orsino.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I admit I didn't sort of take much notice of him in the West End production. And then all of a sudden, I think because of the dynamic between the two of them with Sam Barnett, like, I thought, like, suddenly my eyes were... I could see more of his performance.
Interesting.
So it is... I mean, you know, when people are sort of like, why would you go see the same show more than one time?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that, actually, because I was dying to see it again. So I paid an obscene amount of money to go back and see it a second time. And I thought, people watch Friends reruns ad infinitum. I mean, yeah. You know, forever. And people have favorite movies that they watch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
It doesn't strike me as strange at all to want to just revisit something over and over and over again. And that's why I think there's a certain, like, sadness to knowing that it's just, it's gone now. Although, the first time I saw it, they recorded it. So I know there is, I want to say...
They recorded the New York show?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, no. Some.
Oh, for Lincoln Center? Or...
I want to say, like, PBS or something.
What?
Yeah. They recorded both Richard III and Twelfth Night. So there is a recording of them.
Oh,
and
my
I don't
God.
Know when and how they'll be available, but...
That is a really interesting piece of news.
Yeah. So hopefully it'll be available to be seen widely.
I mean, because this is a production that has been kicking around for over 10 years. And it's, I mean, it was performed 10 years ago and they reinstated the production at the Globe. It was like a sort of a anniversary production. So, which is just an interesting concept anyways. We've been sort of critical of like Cabaret coming back with the same director and the same leading actor. That's exactly what they've done here with Twelfth Night. The ensemble, however, has changed. And like Eddie Redmayne was in it originally.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think he was Cesario. I think he was Viola Cesario. So,
oh, wow.
So it's, I mean, so maybe, you know, for all of our complaining about Cabaret, maybe I should just shut up and accept the fact that really good things sometimes come back.
There's an adorable interview with Sam Barnett in the New York Times this past week.
Yes.
Where some people were mean to him. And now we have a small bounty on those people.
Right. It turns out we have a vendetta against someone. We're not sure who at this point. Because it's funny because the article is like, I don't know if it was Broadway.com or Playbill.
What's the difference? A rude reporter like basically said, do you want to make a statement about being gay? Which is like such a fucking rude thing to say to somebody. Period. In any context.
Yeah. So if you're listening, insensitive reporter out there.
And then, of course, it also becomes the focal point that and his not wanting to eat any French fries.
I know. Like, I
that's the headline of the story. It's the French fries.
And this is the New York Times. So, like, I will take issue with the fact that the reporter didn't. I mean, you choose, you know, you edit and put things in and out of your interviews. And they chose to include, like, what he was eating, salad versus French fries. And then this whole, you know, sort of interlude in the middle about his sexual orientation. And I don't know. It really pissed me off because I was like, A, this guy's acting his fucking face off on Broadway. Who cares what he puts in his mouth? And B, who cares what his personal life is about? I want someone to ask him about his lovely, wonderful Twitter bromance with Jamie Parker, his co-star from The History Boys. And no one fucking bothered to ask about that.
Which I then went and looked up after he mentioned it. And I was like, oh my God, these tweets are amazing.
Yes, they're hilarious. So for those who don't follow, there's actually a Tumblr that's collected a bunch of them because they are just really priceless. I mean, they're friends. And Jamie Parker's married to a lady whose name I forget. Deborah something, maybe? I don't know. And a couple years ago, they actually did a cabaret where the three of them sang, Jamie, oh, wow, his wife, and Sam Barnett, and did all of these Sondheim songs. And I'm talking about them with their first names as if I know them. I don't know any of them. I'm really sorry if I'm being disrespectful. Because I just love you all so much. And so they have this like lovely sort of Twitter bromance where the two of them are always teasing each other. And it's very much out in the open. And but of course, like, obviously all the crazy fangirls are like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And I'm apparently now one of them.
It's kind of like what's happening right here.
right. But in Twitter form.
Yeah.
But they're funny. The two of them are just really funny. And it's, I don't know, I really enjoy anyone who has like any good banter between anyone. It's fun to me. And it's fun to see these two actors sort of have fun with each other. And, you know, they have a real affection for each other. And out in the open that we can all see. And I don't know. I just think it would, like, if I had interviewed Sam Barnett, it would be like, question number one. Oh my God, is Jamie Parker just the best, like, you know, friend that you have? Do you guys love hanging out together? Do you get to see each other? Are you too busy? Tell me all about it. Like, I know you have a boyfriend. I know he has a wife. But, like, tell me about your friendship. Because, like, you know, good friends are hard to find.
Yeah. Adorable people. Adorable people on the internet.
Yep.
All right. Anything else you want to say about 12th night before we never speak of it again?
Oh man, I could talk about it forever. I was wearing my tiara for a little bit.
Yay. What have you seen recently?
Well, Lindsay, I'm glad you asked. Let's start with Let Me Ascertain You, which the two of us saw.
Yeah.
Which I definitely wanted to talk about. I didn't want to miss an opportunity to talk about that.
Good.
It's the cabaret by the Civilians at Joe's Pub. They had another episode recently, which was dubbed Sexual Variants 1941. And usually the Civilians, the way in which they work is they sit down with people, interview them, and from those interviews build monologues, songs, and sort of stories from those sort of direct transcript interviews. And here, they didn't interview anyone. They took the text from a book that was published in 1941 about interviews that a doctor had made of patients in the 1930s about their sexual orientation, and categorized them. I should probably like open up my notes for this. There were three things. They categorized them as homosexuals, bisexuals, and narcissists. And so it was a, that was my note. That's correct. so the doctor, George Henry. So there were actors who performed these monologues about people's own sort of sexual histories that they gave to this doctor. And then there was sort of a narrator who performed the doctor's assessment of these patients. And then there were musical interludes by a variety of different composers and singers doing sort of musical renditions of, again, direct quotes and direct information from these interviews. And it was fascinating.
It was pretty good. It wasn't my favorite one of the Let Me Ascertain You's that I've been to. I thought that usually the thing I find so compelling about the Civilians shows, the Let Me Ascertain You shows, is that they take something that's maybe considered a little weird or a little fringe, but they humanize it in a way that you realize that, oh, everybody struggles, everybody has a difficult time, and there's a certain universality to the things that when you first hear about, you think that's so deviant or different from you, but really it's like, oh, we're all kind of in the same boat. And for this one, it just felt a little bit like not as compelling, because the things they were talking about, while I'm sure very controversial in the 1940s, seem a little, I don't know, blasé today.
I don't know, because that's funny, because I thought it was, you know, you were looking at it with a historical lens.
Yes.
So even the tone, the vocabulary, the way in which somebody would describe their own, you know, sexual conquests in 1930 is going to be different when they discuss them today. They didn't have Twitter and texting back then.
Right.
So I appreciated the kind of historical gloss to it, and I think Steve Kosen, when he introduced it, was sort of like, try to look at this with a little bit of humanity here, because it is coming from a text, is coming from a place where the doctor is, you know, sort of eviscerating these people and, you know, dissecting them conceptually as to, like, how can I categorize this behavior in a way that fits into my scheme of how, you know, what the norms are and what the non-norms are.
Right.
So it's already coming from a place of severe judgment.
Yes.
But I don't know. I kind of liked the, like, in particular, what's sort of coming back to me is the man who liked to dress as a woman and who really believed himself a woman. And that I had a moment of sort of like, there's all this talk lately, and, you know, maybe it's just sort of who I'm following on Twitter and who I'm listening to, but just sort of like conversation about trans people in the world and how that, you know, there's this really like vocal group coming to, you know, coming out and demanding to be heard, demanding to be respected, and demanding attention in a world where, you know, even within the LGBT community, the T often gets forgotten. And so hearing this story from the 1930s made me feel like, oh my God, we haven't come all that far.
Yeah.
Like, here's this person and nobody understands why she thinks herself a woman. So I struggle with my own pronouns about it. I mean, you know, and so we're nowhere, you know, we're no better off for that particular patient. Certainly for many of the others, it would be a very different story today.
Yeah.
As long as they don't live in Kansas.
True. Jesus. Yeah, no, it was quite, I mean, it was good. It just wasn't my favorite of the ones that I've been to of their shows.
I thought it was a little music heavy, which for me is not always my favorite.
But. Interesting. Well, it is available on a podcast. If you go to the Civilians, you can hear it and all of their past episodes of Let Me Ascertain You.
What have you seen lately?
Well, let's talk about the stuff we've both seen. Okay. So we went to Facing Our Truth together, the 6 10-minute plays on Trayvon Race and Privilege. Which couldn't seem more timely given the Dunn verdict. So very, yeah. Very serious issues being raised and talked about and need to be, I think, talked about a lot more. And this production is just an excellent way for people to experience things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to experience. It's an excellent way to try to put yourself in a person's shoes who experience things that you yourself can never experience because of your own race and your own gender. And the final play by Marcus Gardley is an attempt to imagine a scenario where you could literally put on another person's visage and experience what they go through. And I just find that so incredibly compelling. I don't know what you thought about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny because I think it ties in with the other play I think both of us saw, I Call My Brothers,
yep.
Where the journey is so psychological in I Call My Brothers, where you are, I felt like very similar to the Marcus Gardley piece. Like, I am being thrust into a situation where I myself would not normally find myself. And here I am experiencing the terror, the uncertainty, the dangers that come with that. And all we're talking about are people of color walking down the street.
Right.
And that, you know, it is sort of the power of theater to give you that opportunity to see that, hear that story, experience it, and, you know, the lights come up and you get to walk away. And I think for me, with the Trayvon plays, there's a couple within the shorts where somebody gets shot. And, you know, the lights go down, the person is shot, and, you know, as the lights are still down, that person stands up and goes backstage. And for me, in some ways, that was one of the most powerful moments, is like, that person gets a do-over. Like, it's that moment of theater where it's not real, and yet the fact that person is able to get up again, stand up and walk out, and Trayvon Martin isn't the real tragedy and the thing that I keep sort of taking away from it. And I know that it's sort of doing a disservice to all the actual great theater and writing and things that were happening, but for some reason that visual for me was really upsetting and also powerful.
Yeah, it's been interesting following the conversation about these two plays and to see people's reactions to them, and especially the I Call My Brothers play, which I feel like people have gotten sort of lost in the critical conversation, nitpicking over things, and have missed the larger message.
I haven't been following I tend not to read reviews if I haven't seen it. But
the reviews are the reviews are variable in terms of, like, did I like this play or not?
Okay.
But nobody seems to really be getting into the nitty-gritty of the message of the play. Like,
why does this play exist? Because this play needs to exist?
Yeah. And it reminds me a lot of that article you forwarded me. The critical response that was raised in this article you sent me that is in The Guardian. It is an interview with Kwame Kwe Arman, who is a British black male who is in the U.S. serving as the artistic director of Baltimore Center Stage Theater. And in this article, he talks about how when he became the artistic director, there was all this pressure for him to put on Clybourne Park, the Bruce Norris play.
Subscribers were, quote, demanding it.
Yes.
Sorry.
And this is a play that won a Pulitzer Prize, won a Tony, celebrated, I think, is an apt word. And a lot of people have celebrated it because they think it is a powerful conversation on the topic of race in a positive way, in a positive conversation between white and black families across generations in this play.
Right.
And this person in this article says when he saw it, he thought there were things in it that were racist and that reinforce negative stereotypes of black people. And that when he read the critics about that play, nobody raised those issues. It was all middle-aged, middle-class white men celebrating the treatment of race in it. And nobody was talking about what he perceived as very negative things about race in that play. And I just couldn't help but extend that same thinking to all the reviews of I Call My Brothers that I've read, and I've yet to find one by a person who's not white. And everybody, including myself, a white person, is entitled to their perspective on that show, but it would just be so beneficial if we could have some people who might share the perspective or experience of the people in this play and could comment on whether they had similar or shared experiences, or just to move that critical dialogue forward in a way that wasn't just all from the same perspective.
Or even any one of the white reviewers checking their own privilege as they're talking about it, being self-aware. And I think for me, the Facing Our Truth plays, one of the most important parts of that series for me was the question of privilege and how that gets depicted on stage and how you even talk about it, because I think it's one of the most important things we need to talk about now, and we don't talk about it. There's a lot of, you know, sort of pushback immediately from people on, why am I not entitled to my feelings? Why am I not? This is my experience. And it's like, that can still be your experience, but understand the context of privilege your experience is coming from. And I don't know. I just, you know, I felt like we all need a dose of humility in that regard. And I don't know. I thought the play, I thought the writing of I Call My Brothers was fantastic. Like when you have a conversation with a dead grandmother, I'm kind of like, ugh, you had to go there. Like, it felt a little bit like, all right. And, you know, the production was probably not the strongest production of that play to exist, but I'm really glad I saw it. And I really felt like, you know, it was a wonderful companion piece and continuation of the same conversation as Facing Our Truth. Which is, how do you walk down the street as a person of color and not, like, you're hearing, and I Call My Brothers, essentially all the voices in this man's head of both what he's internalized, what he thinks about himself, what he thinks others think about him, and ways in which he calls his brothers to participate in this conversation, in this dialogue. Do you retreat? Do you, you know, walk down the street and make sure everyone else feels comfortable about your presence? Or do you go out there aggressively because you have nothing to hide and you are not the person the police are looking for? So who cares? And, you know, that tension, all of those voices in this character's head, again, are voices we don't hear a lot on stage. And I was really, you know, intrigued by that and thought that part of the play was really effective. Like, I came out sort of nauseous from the...
Yeah. Well, and, you know, any person can imagine what it's like to be under suspicion for something that is totally unwarranted and is on the basis of what you look like or the clothes that you wear, but not related to any action that you've taken yourself. Like, we can all imagine what that feels like. And you can imagine how it would be scary and it would invoke feelings of anger and sadness and paranoia and fear. And all of those things are on display in I Call My Brothers. But the playwright really tries to take it to the next level and dig deeper and not just consider what is your initial response to that feeling of being under suspicion. What is your secondary response? What is the thing that over time wears at you, and it affects not just how you feel, but actually your own perception of yourself. And at some point, does it actually change who you are? And
right. It becomes toxic. The exterior racism becomes an interior toxin that starts to poison you.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I came out thinking, oh, here I am walking down the street every day and not recognizing the privilege that attends my walking down the street every day. And the same with facing our truth. As a person who post law school adopted the black hoodie as my uniform and has worn one nearly every day for like 10 years, including when I worked at a law firm, including trying to go into court wearing one and being told I could not wear a hoodie in court, which I was appalled by and tried to act like, I know that. I'm cold. I'm going to take it off as soon as we get in there. But anyway, and then you hear the conversation of a mother in one of the Facing Our Truth plays, the one by Mona Mansour, talking about the fear she has around the clothes her sons wear. I mean, that's like, she has all this fear about the clothes he puts on his body. Or in another play by Dominique Morisot, a woman's husband goes to leave the house and puts on a hoodie, and she says, "You're not going to wear that, are you?" I've put on a hoodie thousands of times. It has never crossed my mind they would have an effect on my personal safety. I hope that these plays get seen by a lot of people, and I hope that there's a healthy conversation that represents many diverse perspectives, because I don't feel like we're really getting that right now. I'm not pointing to any particular article or review out there and saying like, this person did it wrong. What I'm saying is, gosh, I wish there were more pieces, more articles about this show by people from diverse perspectives.
What you bring up is in continuation of our conversation about looking harder and looking for works, written, directed, produced by people of color. We didn't really talk about it, but even the critical perspective that goes, that is the continuation of that conversation is missing.
Well, and in the future, the basis of people's understandings of these plays starts with the critical response to them. You know, if you're researching a historical production, the very first thing you do is go out and find what all the critics said about it.
Right.
And as far as I can tell, in the future, anybody who wants to know anything about I Call My Brothers is just going to find a multitude of articles written by people who are similar. And I would love to be shown, I would love to be proven incorrect on this fact and to be flooded with articles from people with very diverse backgrounds. Nothing would make me happier. Do we have anything lighter to talk about? So I want to talk. I don't want to talk about this in depth because I know you're going to go see it at some point. I believe.
Probably not.
Okay. Oh, you're not going to go see Kung Fu?
Oh, no. I do have tickets. I don't know.
Oh, my God. If you don't use them, let me know because I'll fucking go again. I don't want to talk about it because I know Jack saw it. And I know when Jack gets here, he's going to want to talk about it.
Okay.
But I just want to tell people that if there are any $25 tickets left to go see this show, you should fucking buy a ticket and go see it. Because it is more entertainment value for $25 than is even reasonable. I mean, look, you put people on stage that are awesome dancers and incorporate fighting and martial arts choreography, and I'm going to love you. This is the best I've seen of that.
How much of that have you seen?
I've seen other shows. Like, just one or two come to mind.
Okay. Well, that's more than I was thinking existed. So
there was one I saw at La Mama recently. Well, last year, the name of which I couldn't possibly remember. But it, my review of it is on Max Moo, but I can't remember what it was called. But that was very good. I was very pleased with that. But this was even better.
Blown you away.
These people are so talented. And there's been some, I don't want to get into it. There's been some criticism of the script. I didn't notice.
You're like, I was having too much fun.
I was on the front row.
Oh my God.
And at one point, Colby, the person who plays Bruce Lee, does a backflip, like practically into the laps of the people on the front row. And all of us were like, and it's right before the intermission. So like all of us were like, oh my God, you almost had him in your lap.
And he's somebody from like Dancing with the Stars or something like that?
No, no, the dancing competition, not so the ballroom. So You Think You Can Dance, which I've never
watched. I don't know what any of them mean, so.
But I believe he was like a second runner up, and okay. He's won a lot of martial arts trophies, like, you know, silver junior champion of Kung Fu, or okay, I don't even know. But he's very good. All I'm saying is if there are $25 tickets left, you should go buy one. And if there are $75 tickets and this is your thing, you should buy one. That's okay. All I'm going to say.
All right.
I don't even know that there are any $25 tickets left because I told my sister to go see it because she's a dancer. She said there's very little availability.
But yeah.
Anyway, it got extended, so there are definitely $75 tickets. Okay. What else, Nicole?
Well, I saw Love and Information.
How was that?
Yesterday. It was very good. There were several audience members who, as they were walking out, passing the director, said this was the worst thing they'd ever seen.
Shut up.
Which
the
made me,
worst?
Yeah, I was like, which made me really question what these people were going to see, because I thought it was actually pretty good. So, I don't know who these people are, but don't listen to them. Sorry, James McDonald. I hope they didn't hurt your feelings, but I also hated your King Lear. So, you know, you and I aren't really simpatico anyway. okay, so Love and Information is essentially an enormous number of vignettes. It is not a, there's no narrative through line between the vignettes. They don't connect. There are 100 different characters, all played by a large group of actors who keep rotating through all of these roles. And essentially, it's not exclusively, but largely two-person scenes. And some of the scenes are as short as one sentence. Wow. And others, there's a little bit more dialogue. And at some point, I was like trying to understand the patterns and like what all of these sections, because it's broken up into 7 sections, and I'm trying to understand, well, what were all of the scenes in section 1 were? You know, is there like a you know, sort of connective tissue that holds these all together? And I kind of just lost, you know, the strands by the end. And I think that's actually the point. You're supposed to feel a little overwhelmed with information.
Oh, right, because it's about the information age.
Right. It's about sort of information. It's about how information impacts you, how it changes you, how it changes your relationship, how the giving of information, the withholding of information. I mean, there are, you know, scenes about secrets. There are scenes about memory. There are scenes about, you know, things people cannot forget. There are things that people cannot remember. And each of the scenes, you know, they're so accessible. Like, it was really a wonderful testament to how much drama you can create with so little. Mm. Like, two people show up, they say a few things to each other based on their clothing, what they say to each other, you know, maybe a little bit of set dressing, but barely any. 99% of the time, you know exactly where you are and who these people are to each other and how much drama is inherent in, you know, a couple sentences between people. And so it's kind of this balance between an overwhelming amount of information flying at you and this incredible sort of beautiful minimalism within each of the individual scenes. Mm-hmm. And I think that dynamic is what I really liked, is the idea that all of these tiny, tiny little pieces somehow add up to just so much, you know, this flood of information. But within each scene, they're the kind of scenes that you want acting students to do, because it takes such control and thought to achieve the, you know, the sort of essentially sort of small goal of each of the scenes, to just communicate that dramatic moment to the audience. And it's funny because, like, the actors, like, some of them I'm like, oh, I've seen you in other things, but your names aren't familiar to me, which is, I think, really helpful because you're not kind of caught up in, oh, that person, I know that person. Mm-hmm. And the scenes could be anything from, you know, there's clearly like a couple in their wedding gear in a limo to people sitting on a beach to two like teenage fangirls to two Elvises in a lounge somewhere. I mean, just, you know, again, no connection between them except in the, you know, giving and taking of information to each other. I don't know. I think it's really worth seeing. I had not seen any Carol Churchill before. I know, I'm the worst. And I thought it was a pretty good place to start. I mean, you know, I think it's the kind of piece that if a less seasoned writer had attempted it, they would have been kind of lost within their own endeavor. And here, I still, as much as I sort of felt a little overwhelmed at the end, still felt like everyone who's doing this work knows what they're doing, even if me and the audience is a little bit lost. And being lost is actually the intent, which isn't necessarily a feeling audience members want to walk away with.
Thus, the people who hated it.
Probably. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like mostly I've heard pretty positive things about it. All right, what are we going to see that we're excited about?
Well, I actually am going to see Kung Fu next week, so I do have that on my schedule, so I'm excited about that.
Good.
Sadly, I'm not sitting in the front row, so I will not have flying abs coming at me.
Well, you know, it's funny because actually my preferred place to sit in a this is not a musical, but there's a lot of choreography. It's actually a really interesting combination of mostly a straight play, but with a tremendous amount of choreography and music, but very little singing. There are a few scenes that are inspired by like Chinese opera, but for the most part, there's no singing. And so
this is fascinating.
And so my point being that normally I would actually want to sit much further back in the theater, because that's really the only way to truly appreciate all the choreography. But there's also something, especially when people are truly doing like feats of human strength and flexibility and agility and jumping, that being extremely close to that is insanely satisfying. I mean, there was a moment in the first act very early on, and I actually let out a little like, ah! Like a little yelp. And I don't think anyone else in the theater did.
That's okay.
This guy just jumped so high in the air and flipped around. I was like so amazed by it.
I mean, I am that person who will randomly laugh at lines no one else in the entire theater finds funny. And I feel really self-conscious about it. It happened to me tonight at 12th Night. I don't know what it was. It was just like I had a line. I was like, and like no one. And I was like, okay, just me. All right, it's fine.
Oh, now you just reminded me of Sam Barnett and I feel sad again.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I'm also seeing the other Josh Cohen next weekend.
Yay! Oh, you are?
In New Jersey.
I've meant to buy a ticket to that and I haven't.
You really
yet.
Should come.
Right. I'm taking Carpool a note.
To New Jersey. A Doll's House at BAM. If you do not buy tickets to this, do not say I didn't warn you.
Really? I don't want to go.
I mean, okay, I will say I have only seen one production of A Doll's House. Did I already talk about this in the podcast? I don't care. I'm talking about it again. I saw Janet McTeer do A Doll's House in like the late 90s, and it was incredible. And she played completely against type, and it really changed the way in which I looked at that play. And so I am looking forward to this, you know, sort of feminist interpretation of A Doll's
Don't
House.
Don't pound on the table.
Okay. I'm very excited. I mean, it could be terrible, and then I'll be really mad, but I'm pretty sure it's not terrible.
Well, no, it's the Young Vic production. It was very well received over in the UK land, so yeah. I assume it's good.
Yeah.
And we all know they have better taste than us. Just kidding. We're not Anglophiles around here. I mean, we love them. I'm not saying bad things about them.
Yeah, I have criticized many things I have seen in London, and if you need a list, I can make one. So they're not perfect. We're not perfect.
We're not
no one's
in the
perfect.
Tank for the Brits, is what we're trying to say.
Right. There are things.
We criticize everyone.
It's
of
true.
All races, genders, ages, nationalities. Please.
It's really true. Although I will say they do Shakespeare better than we do. America, step it up.
Now, next week, we're having a special episode about comedy.
Yay!
What is it?
So this is my brainchild. I'm so excited about this because I didn't really go to a lot of comedy, really. But because of my obsessive fandom with Daniel Kitson, who is both a monologuist in theater space, in this theater space, but also a stand-up comedian. I started seeing a lot more comedy when he was in town doing some stand-up bits, also seeing stuff at the Edinburgh Fringe, and have kind of fallen into this little comedy hole of, you know, just finding some comedians I really like, starting to sort of follow their work, and have met some comedy journalists, and so thought it might be kind of fun to add comedy into this conversation a little bit, because it is part, a huge part of live performance in New York, and there are some really interesting artists, and I think the range of what's out there for comedy is something I never really thought about before.
Massive.
And, you know, it's hard, I think, it, I think much like, you know, picking theater out of, you know, oh my God, there's so much to pick from. Who do, you know, who do I see? Why would I go see that person? Is that something I'm going to like? I thought there was space to sort of talk about sort of comedy that's happening around town. That's, and it's also really affordable.
Yeah.
Compared to theater. Sorry, guys. And because you can go to lineups where there are a bunch of different comics, you really can kind of, you know, oh, if you don't like that guy, don't worry, wait 5 minutes, you'll get somebody else. And so, I don't know, I think there's a lot more space in the comedy world to kind of try on different things, try out different venues, sort of see what, you know, see who's out there. I mean, obviously, there's also a massive amount on, like, YouTube, so you really can check out performers mm-hmm. before you go see someone and get kind of a flavor for their work or their style. But I thought it would be kind of a fun, you know, sort of addition to our conversation.
And I've been dipping my toe in hesitantly because there's very little respect for the fourth wall in comedy. And I find that frightening.
It's true.
So we've been making a concerted effort to see more comedy the past couple of weeks. This week we're going to see Night Train, the Wyatt Snack Show.
And Wyatt is on break or not going to be there. So Hari Kondabalu is going to, and his brother are going to be the guest hosts.
And then who's the other person we're going to see? Louisa?
Louisa O'Malon, who's actually a British comedian who's in town doing a piece comparing her life to Beyonce's life.
As we all should.
Right.
Cool. I'm also going to something called La Opera Burlesque on Tuesday evening.
Will there be a fourth wall?
It is, I think, self-explanatory. It's like burlesque opera or opera e burlesque. I think probably the latter actually is the more apt description. Opera e burlesque.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm going to that. I'll check it out and report back.
Awesome.
And then I went to the Julia Weldon concert last night and it was so awesome, and she's doing a free show at the Knitting Factory on Friday that I'm hoping to go to after I see Stage Kiss at Playwrights Horizon.
Oh, right. We're seeing that together.
Oh, you're coming to that?
I think I had the ticket and you followed me.
No, I think other way around.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm going with like my friends who I go to all the Playwright stuff with.
Oh, okay. Well, then I guess I'm stalking you.
Awesome.
Interesting.
It's about high time. Alrighty. I think that's a wrap. That's a good one.
Great. We didn't introduce ourselves, but I think it's fine.
That's okay. I think everyone knows who we are. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Max Moo podcast. Please let us know what you thought about it. You can find Max Moo on Facebook at Max Moo NY. You can find us on Twitter at Max Moo. You can find Nicole on Twitter at Mildly Bitter. That's MILDLYBITTER. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens. LINDSAYBARENZ. I hope you'll join us next week for our special comedy episode. We'll see you then.